I'd say later, the hospital and practice, simulation surgery, write research papers, all of that's unpaid.
Did people think when you were a doctor that you were doing quite well?
I was coming away with 2,300. It's almost offensively easy to replace that kind of income. Been in property for just over 12 months now.
Your properties that you're taking on are big.
30 bed, HMO. Net profit, that one will bring in about 15,000.
If everybody who was a doctor came on my crash course, came financially free like you have, we'd be screwed. Dr. Declan Archer.
You all right?
Welcome to Winners on a Wednesday.
Thank you very much.
We knew this day would come, didn't we?
Eventually.
We knew it would happen.
I've been dragged here a little bit, but yeah.
But you've been so successful. And I know you're I don't know if it's your profession, doctors, but your whole way is kind of keep your cards close to your chest.
Absolutely.
Just do your thing quietly.
Absolutely. Be humble, I think.
Be humble.
Don't brag too much and work on it in the background.
But you've achieved so much. Just tell us in a nutshell, then we can break it down. But what have you achieved in the last year or so in property?
Yeah, so kind of been in property for, I guess, just over 12 months now. In terms of what I achieved, so serviced accommodation is primarily what I've been doing at the moment. Rent to serviced accommodation and lease options to serviced accommodation. So have 5 of those at the moment. And then have started branching out into the social housing space as well, just because that kind of aligns with what I care about a little bit more.
Yeah.
As much as I like the holiday service accommodation side, in terms of what matters to me, I think social housing is where I want to go.
And your properties that you're taking on are big. So you say I've got 5 this, and 5, but let's just talk about the scale, because that's the thing. Like the last deal that you got, was it?
Yeah, so more recently they're becoming big. Classic economies of scale, it actually just makes financial sense to take
How
on
big are
larger
we talking?
Stuff. So like 30 units being the largest that I officially have, and then there's a lot of negotiations for 59 units, which hopefully will be coming pretty soon.
30
and then,
units, man.
And then even higher than
Where is that one that you've got?
That's in Middlesbrough. Middlesbrough up in the northeast of England.
30 units.
Yeah.
And what is it?
Converted care home. So it's like a 30-bed HMO with 12 shared bathrooms.
Do you rent to rent it, or have you got the option to buy it?
So that one's just a commercial lease. I was actually offered the potential for a lease option, but it's not really in the area that I would want to have particular ownership over the property. So kind of went for a commercial lease rather than a lease option with that one. I mean, it's 5 years long, so there's scope for discussions further down the line if it's what I think.
How much does that one make a month?
So net profit, that one will bring in about 15,000.
15 grand a month profit. That's just incredible, man.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. And the lease options, you've got 2 lease options.
Yeah, so we've got a 4-bedroom house in Gateshead, which is just over the...
Yeah, I know it very well.
Yeah. And then also have a 2-bedroom flat in an Erical Blythe, which is like Northumberland, just north of Newcastle. Both of those kind of serviced accommodation, mainly for construction. So there's ridiculous amounts of work going on in like central Newcastle for construction work. And then there's a reasonable amount in Northumberland as well.
Yeah.
With like wind farms being made and stuff
and
like that.
And now your thing is you're looking to take on more blocks.
Yeah, I think so. I think when you just look at, you know, it's quite interesting. You know, I mean, I had trouble getting my first rent to rent, and you know, they're 3-bedroom houses, and you look at the amount of work that goes into getting one of those versus the amount of work and taking on a 30-unit converted care home. The difference isn't huge. I mean, there's a little bit more pieces to, you know, work around, and it's
a bit more complicated on the legal side.
Yeah, it can get a little bit messier, and trying to align contracts so that it's secure for me as well as, you know, the different social housing groups and that I'm kind of working with.
Yeah.
But like, it's certainly not 30 times difficult.
I mean, I said this to my brother recently. We just bought a hotel.
Yeah.
And we bought the hotel business and the hotel building, the freehold building.
Yeah.
And the amount of paperwork I was having to go through.
Mm.
We're also getting a mortgage as well on the property, a commercial mortgage.
Yeah.
And I was having to like sign, you know, apply for the mortgage, this, sign this, the lease, the hotel, all this paperwork, and I was going through it and I was thinking, geez, I mean, as it happens, we can make a lot of money off of this hotel.
Yeah.
If this was just a house.
Yeah.
A 200 grand house.
It's not worth it.
I mean, yeah, the paperwork might be a bit less. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to bother buying it. Just the amount.
Yeah.
So, and this is one of the things I learned, which you've applied very much to your property business, which is if you're going to grow and scale a business, rather than growing in terms of number of properties and number of deals. Oh, I did 10 deals last year. Next year, I'm going to do 100.
Yeah.
It's much better to say, I did 10 deals last year. I'm going to do 5 next year, but they're going to be 20 times as big.
Absolutely.
And grow that way.
Yeah. It just financially makes sense as well. I mean, your overheads end up being quite scary.
Yeah.
Because they are quite
high.
Absolutely. But if you break it down in terms of number of units, actually your overheads compared with taking on, you know, say one bedroom flats as rent to rents,
yeah,
your overheads are actually quite significantly smaller. So, yeah. And that's where the profit's made, is basically through classic economies of scale and the reduced overheads.
Do you have any blocks on lease options or your lease options?
No, so the lease options are literally a four bedroom house and a two bedroom flat,
right?
But the block that I'm currently negotiating, which is well, it's basically 12 apartments but 59 en suite rooms, so that's, I'm trying to get that as a lease option.
So it's looking like it's going
to
come off.
I'm hoping so, yeah. Again, there's lots of different, you know, pieces to the puzzle, but I mean the crux is it's a block where the person wants to sell within 5 years. They want $35,000 a month for it. The numbers make sense at that point. I don't really see why not. And, you know, if it's a commercial lease, I'm happy with that anyway. And again, it gives you that time where maybe, you know, take it on as a commercial lease over 5 years, but at 12 months, let's negotiate. Oh, do you want to sell in the next 4 years or whatever? And then convert it to a lease option there. So,
what kind of a doctor are you?
So eye surgery is my specialty. I have slightly took a step back from that. So as well as doing that, I do kind of general emergency medicine and stuff like that as well. Right. Just to
practicing doctor?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not full time or anything. It would be probably average, as like 2 days a week sort of thing.
Were you full time a year ago?
Yeah. So I left full time work in February.
Right, and because of the property stuff.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's,
yeah, it is nice. Do you know what? Doctors work so many hours.
It's ridiculous.
Oh my goodness. I was at the my wife had to have a small surgery.
Yeah.
Last month, and the doctor that I was had been working since 7 a.m. I said, "What time did you finish?" She said, "It'll be about 8-9 o'clock in the evening."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was thinking, how can you work 14 hours with that much concentration as a doctor? And he was just, "Oh, it's normal."
Yeah, it's normally, he's probably not being paid for a lot of those hours as well. And then he'll go home and he'll have X, Y, Z, other stuff. So I'd go home and, well, I'd stay late at the hospital and practice simulation surgery. I'd then go home and write research papers because that's what you need to do. And then also trying to develop clinically, you know, your knowledge on the side. And so, and all of that's unpaid. So it was just,
wow,
exhausting.
Have you replaced your income already?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're earning now, you've replaced your...
I mean, post-tax and university debt, I was coming away with £2,400 a month.
Jeez.
Yeah, so it's almost offensively easy to replace that kind of income.
£2,300 as a doctor, working crazy hours.
Yeah, but yeah, base hours, 40 a week.
Were you working for the NHS?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty difficult to not work for the NHS in the UK. Unfortunately,
at least madness
until you're a consultant and then have the freedom.
What a skilled job though, and you had to go to uni presumably.
I got 4 degrees, 5 years medicine, a master's in the middle of medicine. I've done 2 additional degrees alongside work.
How much did all of your training cost
To be a doctor? I mean, about £80,000 of university debt.
How can you spend £80,000 training and then be making £2,300? That blows my mind.
Yeah, it blows my mind as well. It's kind of a reality that not many people who apply for are aware of. And I think in the UK as well, you know, we have this perception of, well, you shouldn't be doing it for money. But, you know, I mean...
No, but you need to be paid for what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm council estate lad. My parents rent a council house. You know, the thought is, well, at least when I was applying, is hopefully this will be a career where I can support them, whatever. And then you realise you're actually kind of struggling financially.
Do people think when you were a doctor, do people assume that you were doing quite well financially?
Yeah, they'd assume you're making at least double what you're making.
Yeah. Oh, I did. Until now.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were so poorly paid.
Base salary as a ophthalmic surgeon, as a trainee, you know, I was on £42,000 base salary.
Yeah. But then you've got, as you mentioned, you've got
your... And then you've got all the other stuff.
Your tax, your debts.
Yeah. And then all the free work on the side as well. So
yeah,
it just, yeah, absolutely exhausting. I think I did quite a lot when I was at university. I was fairly high achieving, got a pretty damn hard job to get. So I think I kind of realised what the reality of the future career was going to be, and not many people are very happy. You know, the surgeons who you go and see who probably did your wife's surgery is probably not that happy. So
yeah,
it's not really where I want
to go. I said to him, and now I regret saying it, because when he told me how many hours he was working, I said, "Oh, well, I hope you're getting paid well." Yeah. And he just didn't say anything.
He didn't say anything.
No, 100%, yeah, he just didn't say it. He was just kind of, you know, he was probably thinking, nope, yeah, not really.
Absolutely. He's probably on £25.
It's a shame, really, because we need doctors.
It's
if everybody who was a doctor came on my crash course, joined the academy, became financially free like you have, we'd be screwed.
Absolutely, yeah.
We need doctors.
I completely agree. Yeah, it's frustrating because, unfortunately, I've kind of got the point where I'm just like, that's not my problem. There's... Many of my friends are just exhausted with it all, burnt out.
Do they want to get into property now too, or have you kept it a secret?
So I haven't kept it as much of a secret from them. They're quite encouraging and they're interested in investing and stuff with me. I think most of them want an exit plan. No one's going into medicine with the intention of that being their long-term career anymore. Right. Most of them are either going into GPs where you have a bit more flexibility where you can teach and stuff as well, or others are kind of planning their exit route.
Yeah.
But taking that jump from something that you've committed to for so long is really quite
difficult. Your stuff though that you've been doing, like, rent to rent, serviced accommodation, lease option agreements. It's quite hard work.
Mm.
It's not like investing in property where you've got a couple hundred grand and you just buy a house and rent it out.
Yeah.
That's not that difficult. That's quite easy. Mm-hmm. But going out like you've done and securing lease options, that's like time consuming. So how did you manage to do that whilst being a doctor?
Yeah, so I mean, like everyone says, you know, in your evenings and stuff, luckily like Gumtree, Open Rent, Facebook Marketplace, you know, the 24/7 things, they're not kind of confined to, I guess I haven't used estate agents probably as much as other people because I didn't have the time during 9 till 5 to be able to make all of these calls. So a lot of them were pretty much like off market sort of stuff where I'd go see them if I had a Saturday off. And then a component of my job, as well as doing the eye surgery, was like research, which gives you a little bit more flexibility. So I had 2 days a week of doing research.
And you say researching property deals, does
well,
that count?
I mean, it gives you a bit of flexibility, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I do.
If you work from home, because you've not got the travel and all the...
Exactly, so it was that sort of thing. So I guess I was a little bit fortunate there where, you know, I'd spend evenings writing up research papers and could give myself a morning to try and do some property stuff. So just worked it around that largely, and then since February I've pretty much been full time with a bit of locum work here and there.
Talk to me about, for anyone who doesn't know, the power of lease option. What is a purchase lease option and how can you buy properties using no money on lease option agreements?
You've
done it.
So I mean, I think the power from my perspective is, you know, you can take on a property without having to put much up financially, and you have the exclusivity to purchase it in the future. You then use it for cash flow, or you kind of cross your fingers or look at the market research and hope that capital appreciation comes with it, and then you're technically buying below market value. And then I think what's often not talked about is, well, what's actually the power of it for the seller? So it's often finding people who are in real difficulties and you're actually providing a solution to them. So like, for example, the flat that I've took on, this was a guy who was just renting out to a private tenant, and the last 2 times he's done that, they've trashed his flat. So this was literally a Facebook Marketplace message, but met with him and he was just like, I never want to rent to a private tenant ever again. They keep trashing all my stuff. Trying to kick them out is impossible. And it's actually costing me more money because I'm having to do a full refurb after each 6 months when they leave. So basically I was able to come to him and say, well, how about my company takes it on? Here's my credibility based on X, Y, Z that I've already done. And I'll also purchase it he was in negative equity with it as well. So let me purchase it to solve that negative equity problem. But equally, I'll look after it. I'll do the maintenance in the meantime. And this is where I'll get my profit. So
lovely.
Great for me. But I think the main thing with lease options is you're actually providing a solution. I don't really think it works unless you've got an amazing relationship with, you know, a portfolio landlord. I don't think it works unless you're really solving someone's big problem.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And lease option agreement is the kind of thing where you need to have it in your pocket, don't you?
Yeah.
It's not going to work for everybody. It's a lot of people that are selling their houses, they need the money to move on with their life, or they need the money to reinvest in another property.
Yeah.
That's not going to work. Because if you say, I'll buy off you in 7 years' time, they're like, well, no, I need the money now.
Yeah.
But your guy, he didn't have any equity because he'd bought it and it had dipped. So even if he sold it now, he'd make nothing.
Yeah.
And the property was a liability to him because he'd be mismanaging it. He'd had issues with tenants. So you're now saying, I'll rent it through a company. If I don't pay the rent, you can kick me out within 7 days.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to get full rent and I'll buy it off you in how many years?
So the flat is 4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, I've struggled to find longer ones, like 7, 10 years.
I remember when I bought one for 7 years. I agreed to buy it after 7 years.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have any money.
Yeah.
And then it shot up in value.
Yeah.
And then the seller's like, And he asked me in the sixth year, he said, can we have a coffee? And I thought, I know where this is going.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, you know, with a lease option agreement, if it goes up in value, you have the option to buy. Not the obligation, you don't have to buy. Mm. If it goes up, that's your capital appreciation there.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, and I guess sometimes they might just need a reminder of, well, I've actually got you out of this real difficulty right. that you were having.
And were they represented by sisters, your guys?
Yeah. That's so it's all been done.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's another thing. If my guy had said to me, can we have a coffee? And then basically, I don't want to sell it to you for the price that we agreed.
Yeah.
If we hadn't have had a solicitor representing him, he could have just said, I didn't know what I was signing.
Exactly, yeah.
And then I've lost all that capital appreciation.
Yeah. So even, I mean, I've paid solicitor fees for one of mine, but I just think, you know, it's even, you know, you're paying an extra 1,500, whatever, up front, but you're securing that yourself.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think they're a great strategy. I think they're a great strategy at the moment as well. I mean, I've got a negotiation of a hell of a lot of them at the moment because I just feel people aren't wanting to drop the prices as much as, you know, to get a good below
but
market value.
Because of the way the market is. But then
they either have to or they have to wait for the price that they want done. And I think people are increasingly realizing they have all these liabilities, mortgage, bills, whatever. And rather than taking a big 25% below market value cash offer, unless they're really, really, really desperate and really need that cash, they would rather wait. So I'm actually finding more people are almost like proposing a lease option to me when I'm there having a chat with them. Yeah, it's really quite
interesting.
It's funny
because a year and a half ago, Declan, it wasn't like that at all. Like, it was actually hard getting a lease option.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a year and a half ago, people could just sell it like that.
Yeah.
But now, because of interest rates, because it's more of a buyer's market.
Yeah.
There's people that have got their house on the market. It's been on the market for 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
What's the clever way that you do to find your lease options?
So I guess the main way is kind of post-auction direct vendor letters.
Talk to me about that strategy.
Yeah. So, I mean, initially kind of started thinking about that when I was looking to do a bit of property trading, which is quite interesting to me, you know, finding stuff that's marketed poorly that hasn't sold at auction, get a below market value purchase and then just sell without actually doing stuff with a bit of extra marketing. That was the main reason. But again, I found people really reluctant to drop the price. And the reason that I kind of found things weren't selling at auction was because people weren't willing to take that type of discount. They were guided too high, inappropriately, whatever. So I just started reaching out to, you know, things that hadn't sold on 2 to 3 cycles at auction, sending them a letter saying, you know, there's a potential way that I might be able to help solve your problem. Can we have a chat? And that's actually been really, really effective.
Is that how you got both of your deals?
No, actually. That's the way I'm... There's one other going through legals at the moment. That's how I got that one.
Yeah.
And it's brought a lot of leads and I've had many conversations where, you know, I'm hoping to secure more through that. The ones previously were basically, what was it? One was at auction. It wasn't with a post-auction offer. I can't actually remember how I did that one. But the other one was Facebook Marketplace.
And the thing is as well, like if people haven't got money and they want to own a lot of properties, but they haven't got 100 grand here, 100 grand there, having a lease option, it's almost as good as buying it because all the capital appreciation is yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can buy it at the end.
Yeah.
And you can then, as you said, you can rent it out and save the cash flow as the deposit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or buy it on a bridge at the end. There's so many things you can do.
Yeah, or, you know, even the potential to add value during that period. So almost doing a BRR without having to put through the deposit. Getting financing on that's a little bit more challenging, but as long as you can get investor financing to fund your BRR, then if you can actually take it on as a lease option, add value to it, then you don't necessarily have to wait that 5-year period. Why don't you exit it early? Then you have ownership of it and you've uplifted the value. So it's basically like, I think, an umbrella where you can utilize all the different strategies within that, but without having to put up a huge amount of money up front.
Do you worry when you take on a whole block that you're not going to be able to rent it out and you're going to be absolutely screwed? Because if you're renting out one little apartment, not only do you know it's going to work, but also if it doesn't work, it's only $1,000 a month.
Yeah,
you can cancel your break clause. You can, it's not, whereas if you've got like 20, 30, 40, 50 all in one block,
yeah,
it seems like a huge risk.
Yeah, so it depends on your exit, really. I mean, my exit is basically emergency housing for vulnerable people through a variety of social housing groups, which are mainly Home Office funded. Yeah. So it's actually fairly guaranteed for me, to be honest with you.
Tell me, like that block that you got.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the structure of that and who you're renting it to.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was literally found on Rightmove. There was rooms all individually for rent, looked... They'd all been kind of painted in the same way, but were slightly different. So I just kind of spoke to the agent and was like, you know, I see there's a lot of rooms in this block as the scope to take on the whole thing. They kind of weren't done up to a great standard. They were initially intended to be student accommodation, but, you know, students have fairly high demands for the quality of their accommodation now. So it wasn't going to get the rent that they wanted. So I kind of looked at it and thought, well, maybe I can be the one person to provide a solution here because they've been trying to rent these for ages. They'd missed the student market as well in September. So all the students in Middlesbrough, Teesside Uni or whatever it's called, had already got their accommodation sorted. So this landlord was kind of there with kind of suboptimal accommodation and with no one to rent it to. Mm. So I kind of thought, well, what's the potential solution to that? And I'd built relationships with a bunch of social housing providers in the Northeast for quite a while, took them for coffees, said what my career was, that my aim was, you know, to provide good, high quality accommodation to vulnerable people. Is there a way that we can kind of work through this? And then through conversations, because initially it was, you know, buy a house, rent it out to a family for 5 years on an FRI lease through whatever social housing group. But then through conversations, basically found out that they also do have a component which is emergency housing, which is basically slightly lower than serviced accommodation rates, but still guaranteed monthly for a 5 year period.
Wow.
Yeah, so ridiculous.
So really, it's your connections then?
Absolutely. I mean, probably 9 months of having conversations with no particular like financial intention from my side, just, you know, I want to work with these type of people, I want to provide accommodation for vulnerable
people. But
from
the landlord's perspective, he's really happy because he's got a guaranteed rent.
Well, yeah, so it's basically a rent to rent, so I'm basically the middleman, so I'm giving the landlord market rent, which he would not be able to achieve from anyone else on a 30 bedder. So he's making fantastic money, you know, about 120,000 a year, which otherwise was sat doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically subletting it to a large social housing provider at, I mean, that one's £47 per night per room.
What kind of contracts do you need then for this?
So a commercial lease,
yeah,
with the landlord, and then basically the social housing groups have their own specific contracts. And we, through a little bit of negotiation from my solicitors on their side, basically refine them so they're fair, because they are generally a little bit more tailored towards helping out the social housing group, their typical one. So a little bit of negotiation there just to kind of make sure everybody's happy.
That's what you get paid for.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has it made you rethink your entire business plan in terms of property? Are you now just thinking, I just want to be renting to housing associations?
Yeah, renting housing associations on an emergency basis.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's providing the perfect solution. Landlords want good guaranteed rent. Social housing groups aren't taking on these hotels and stuff, which is kind of suboptimal accommodation for people anyway. So it's pretty much being the middleman, doing all of the, you know, contracts with cleaning, all the maintenance, all the headache, basically, which can be systemized quite nicely, though. And then taking the fee in the middle.
Yeah.
So social housing group doesn't want to deal with all that headache. The landlord doesn't want to deal with all that headache, but wants a good guaranteed rent. I'm happy to deal with and systemize the headache, but then take a fee in the middle.
So now you're looking for small apartment blocks.
I'm looking for 50 plus unit apartment blocks, really.
Whereabouts?
Nationwide, predominantly northeast at the moment, but also kind of Midlands, northwest.
When you were talking to housing associations and you were kind of doing all your networking, how were you received and what were you saying to them?
Yeah, so initially it's really difficult to get to the right person. I mean, you generally find as well with these groups that it's, you know, one employee doing three people's jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you really need to demonstrate, I guess, your credibility, that you have the right intentions. You know, my intention obviously is to build a sustainable, profitable business from it. But my intention is also to provide vulnerable people with good, high quality accommodation. You know, we're putting a library in the one in Middlesbrough to help, you know, this will probably be mainly for asylum seekers, but to help them, you know, learn English, to integrate into society, to be able to contribute to society more. So I think that's kind of what got me the good connections and kind of got my foot in the door and almost a degree of exclusivity, because with this current block that I'm negotiating, I do know someone else has took the same block to the company, and they called me and basically said, we kind of want to just work with you because we know, I mean, it probably helps that I'm a doctor, but, you know, want to help out vulnerable people, and, you know, you've got the credibility because you've done this before.
Do you use the doctor card a bit when you're talking to her?
I really don't, to be honest. I don't.
I would.
It's, I've never introduced myself as a doctor, baby.
I would be
Dr.
Deck. That's all I'm, that's, my name's Dr. Deck. Good to meet you. Did I tell you I'm a doctor, by the way? That'd be me.
I mean, it probably, hopefully brings a bit of professionalism and a bit of credibility.
Especially when you're talking about housing vulnerable people and emergency accommodation.
Yeah. I guess I use it when I feel it's relevant, so, you know, to do a rent to rent for serviced accommodation, unless it's for healthcare professionals.
It's always relevant, bro. You're a doctor. It's always relevant.
Yeah.
You spent 80 grand for training.
Well, exactly, for those two letters. I guess I'm just trying to bring a bit of humility in it as well, but I kind of get what you're saying, and I probably should do it a little bit more. But particularly in the social housing space, hopefully it does demonstrate.
So what is it then?
Intentions.
So what do they exactly do, the housing associations? And how do they get paid?
How do they get paid? Yeah. So, well, I mean, the specific ones that I'm working with, how do they get paid? Well, the Home Office has a pot of money that's allocated by
the
government.
And it's a big pot, right?
And it is a big pot. And that's money that, you know, and so if we're talking specifically about asylum seekers, although my intention is to branch out and help, you know, homeless people with specific healthcare needs, whatever. But if we're talking specifically about, you know, Home Office funded social housing groups for asylum seekers, you know, there's a pot of money that's there which needs to be utilised. By international law, these people have to be housed in good, high quality accommodation. So, I mean, that's their pot of money. That's how they get paid. In terms of how I get paid, it's by basically, you know, they have emergency accommodation and then it branches out into different houses for longer term accommodation. So it basically is a serviced accommodation business.
Yeah. Oh,
but,
yeah.
But specifically just for the Home Office. So they have their pot of money. They need to utilise it. We have these people by international law who we need to protect and provide good, high quality accommodation. But dealing with a big, massive serviced accommodation unit is not what these social housing groups want to be doing. And equally, most people, the landlords, can't be bothered with all of that hassle too.
No.
So, you know,
from the landlord's perspective, it would imagine how much time you spend back and forth with the contracts.
Yeah.
Also, if there's any problems, you'll have to deal with it.
They need 24-hour security, they need 24-hour maintenance.
Yeah. Did you find though that the housing associations that you were speaking to, did they all want big stuff, or did some of them, because I rent a lot of my 4-5 bed, 6 bed HMOs.
Yeah.
Housing associations.
So for emergency,
I've even got houses. I've even got like 2-bed houses.
Yeah. So for emergency housing, they need big stuff.
Right.
For kind of standard 5-10, sometimes 25-year FRI leases, where they'll give you just above market rent.
Would you consider investing in blocks yourself, buying a block and renting it to the housing association?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, ideally through lease option agreements, because, I mean, I do think that kind of provides the solution to the landlord as well, because you can give them a bit of a higher price than they could get for it now. And equally, you know, give them a few years to have some good rental income coming through too. But then it's great for me because I don't have to put down bloody several hundred thousands, which I don't
But how much would it cost to buy a block in the Northeast?
The 30 bed was up for 1.1 million. And
but that's only, you don't have to put down 30%.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a few hundred thousand.
Yeah.
And then you'd own it.
You would. I think for me personally, I would rather go down the lease option way. I think what's really interesting about lease options with larger things is you don't hit the same kind of like reluctancies that if you were wanting to take on a 2-bedroom flat, because, you know, that's from that's like a family who has an emotional relationship.
Mate,
with it.
100%. I secured a hotel this year on a lease option agreement. And when I'm approaching hotels or commercial properties, they get it.
Yeah.
You don't even have to...
They suggest it to you.
Yeah. You don't have to sell it to them.
Yeah.
You just... Even if you ring up an agent, a commercial agent, you can just say, would they consider an option?
Yeah.
And they'll be like, probably would. Let me speak to them.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you say that about a small house or a residential apartment, what?
Yeah, you're never getting through. Yeah, absolutely. So it's purely business. And I actually think most people would want to have that... guaranteed rental income, let me kind of see, and the higher profit at the end as well.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, everything's win-win, isn't it?
Also, another little tip is if you see on commercial property, it says all inquiries welcome.
Yeah.
That means we'll do a lease option.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing then for you the biggest asset you have is your network.
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess network and knowledge. Yeah, because, God, I mean, if you ever suggested 2 years ago to attempt to take on things that are this sort of size, it sounds absolutely ridiculous.
That's funny, though, that you say that.
Yeah. I mean, in such a short period of time.
You have to pinch yourself sometimes.
I think, yeah, it is just a bit like, how do I have the balls to go for these kind of things? You know what I mean? But once you've kind of run the smaller units, you do actually realize that it is very doable. So I think I mean knowledge is the main thing. You can't always find your own deals, but I mean, in terms of network,
how important, you're a doctor, so you believe in education, you spent 80 grand on your education.
Yeah,
how important is the academy and investing in that network and knowledge being to help you with your property journey?
It's absolutely essential, really, isn't it? I mean, I particularly think the mentorship, because even when I was trying to secure a 3-bed house rent-to-rent, there's no way that I would have been able to have done it appropriately, legally, ticked off all the boxes, had the right contracts in place without being able to run things by people. Yeah. Even now, I'm very new to it, I say even now, but in 5 years' time, I still think having an experienced person to bounce things off is just incredibly important. Go to my, profession being a doctor, it's very rare that we make a decision on our own. I'll speak to some other doctors and be like, this is a little bit complicated. What's your thoughts on this? What's your thoughts on this? Yeah. What's the best way to approach it? I think when you're trying to do large things and trying to do them creatively, having a variety of different people with different experiences to be able to bounce ideas off.
Right.
And for them to say, actually, yeah, this does make sense. Why don't you go for that?
Well, really I use valuable. Doctor. You may have even heard me, but when I'm selling the academy, I say, look, if you want to be a doctor, you have to go to university.
Yeah.
If you don't, why is someone going to, no one would trust you with surgery on your eye.
Yeah.
If you said, don't worry, I've watched a lot of YouTube videos.
yeah.
Right? So if they're not going to trust you with their eye, why should someone entrust you with their apartment block building?
Yeah.
If you've not got properly trained.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would someone invest in you if you aren't prepared to invest in yourself? You know, it doesn't make any sense.
100%. And I think, like, particularly when you're dealing with commercial agents and stuff like that who know what they're talking about.
You look like an idiot.
Yeah. If you're trying to, like, BS your way through that, they'll see you straight through it. Yeah. So I think
it's embarrassing.
Oh, yeah. And they'll never work with you ever again if you're like that, or if you're dodgy or whatever. So I think being able to, like, have the knowledge articulated to someone in the field who knows what they're talking about, that builds your credibility. So even this, block that I'm hoping to take on soon, I had a chat with the agent. He was like, even if this falls through, I think we should really work together on this.
That's great when that happens. Yeah,
because he's, all he does is apartment blocks. That's his entire agency.
Beautiful.
So it's that kind of credibility and that knowledge, which I think builds those relationships, which actually allows you to have a sustainable business rather than just like a one-off, let's make a quick buck from this sort of thing. So
none of the housing associations that you spoke to are looking for small houses or...
So they are, but not on emergency housing rates.
Okay.
So typically, they'll give you a 5-10 year FRI lease at about market rent, sometimes a little bit lower than market rent because they deal with all the maintenance stuff. Yeah. Whereas the emergency housing is, the intention is people come in for a few days and then get allocated to these family houses.
How much then? How big would the block need to be for them to be interested?
So a minimum of 50 units now.
50?
Yeah. So kind of purpose-built student blocks or apartment blocks. So that's almost exclusively.
And how much would they rent you for? What about my apartment block? 50 in Wolverhampton.
Okay. Yeah. How much would there? So, there's a lot of conversations about, where can the numbers work so your margin is worthwhile you
I'll get,
doing
if
it.
I rent that out as a normal AST contract, so you're talking about £700-£900 an apartment.
Okay.
If I do it for serviced accommodation, obviously it'd be more.
Yeah.
The problem with serviced accommodation is there's 50.
Yeah.
You're competing with each other.
Yeah.
Is the demand big enough 100%. In Wolverhampton?
Absolutely. I mean, generally what I find is it's about kind of £10 to £15. I mean, don't quote me on this because each one's different and there's conversations that, make sure it's worthwhile for everyone. But kind of £10 to £15 below serviced accommodation nightly rates. But 100% occupancy.
So it might be about £70 a night.
Something like that. Maybe. Yeah. So for the ones that I'm looking at.
So a couple grand a month, probably. I'll quote you on that. A couple of grand. Now, there's many factors.
Yeah. So the ones that I'm the one that I have is £47 per night per room. The other one's looking about £54. That's below market serviced accommodation that you raise.
So you can potentially get more than double. More than double what you get as an AST.
Yeah, pretty much.
Especially if you're in somewhere like Middlesbrough. Because in Middlesbrough, for an apartment, you ain't going to get more than about £500-600.
Yeah, about 600, yeah.
So that's incredible. I mean, that's how you really maximise your profits.
Yeah. But then equally provide a good service for it as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and you have to be able to... I mean, there's so much hassle associated with it, at least up front, and your overheads are so high, your margin has to be worth it. And they do understand that. So,
100% occupied, though, that's the big thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's pretty much a guaranteed rent, a rent to rent, and then sublet to another guaranteed rent.
Yeah.
And take the profit with
Well, that's how I got into social housing about 4 or 5 years ago. One of my students, called Andy, pitched me on a rent to rent on one of my HMOs.
Okay.
And he was offering an amount, and I thought, dude, how are you going to make money?
Yeah.
How are you going to make money? And he said, social housing.
Yeah.
And I thought, all right. So he took it off me, rented it to me, and then he passed it to a housing association.
Yeah.
He don't make a lot of money on it.
No.
But for him, it's very much passive.
It's hands off, isn't it? And he might have made £300 a month from it, but it's hands off, guaranteed for 10.
I don't care. And he's had it the whole time. He's had it for about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, then we started going direct to housing associations, and now my parents have even got their own housing association, which is cool, but that's based in Buckinghamshire.
Well, I did though. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm
thinking of buying something just for them.
Yeah.
Because it makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great way to do things. I think it is about being a credible landlord though, and because I think often, you know, you find that some landlords might give suboptimal accommodation. I think it's really now they are making sure that people are being given good, high-quality accommodation. So it's almost like lifting up the standard for what social housing should be, which is exactly what I want.
Yeah, they're more picky now than they were a few years ago.
100%.
Because before, housing associations were desperate for houses, but I think people are beginning to cotton on.
Yeah.
And now people are giving more...
It's a bit of a sexy subject now, isn't it, social housing?
Yeah, it is.
So you have to run it as a good, reputable business rather than just, here's some houses, chuck some people in it.
What do you mean by that, though?
So as in, I think the pure reason why I'm building these relationships with the social housing groups is because of my credibility, what I've done so far, that I'm providing high quality accommodation, that I'm passionate about trying to build the community.
But how do they know that?
Because of what I've demonstrated in this.
So you show them your other properties?
I show them what I've done. I've shown them this 30 bedder that I'm taking.
Right.
Okay,
so you're talking about if you're trying to do rent to rent housing association, and you go in and you're pitching to housing associations and supported living companies, but you're brand new, you've got no experience, you've got no training, they're just going to think, oh, whatever.
Yeah, I think so.
And you were speaking to the wrong people anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I was, like I say, it took 9 months for me to be able to build up the relationships that I have. And that was all through kind of credibility. I think that's allowed me to kind of have...
Do you plan on continuing being a doctor? Is that the plan?
Plan is probably continue do a few shifts here and there just to maintain
license.
My license.
Yeah.
I mean, the end goal is, you know, have a charity, ideally internationally, and provide free healthcare. But kind of need to sort out, you know, myself.
Have we not already got
my family
called NHS?
Not so much internationally. I think what I find is, so I'm very interested in global health and the problems, particularly when you look at eye surgery and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you'll have a lady who's 40 years old who's had a cataract since she was born. She's never seen her kids, never been able to contribute to their local economy, whereas we operate on people who have very minor eye problems here, in my opinion. So my kind of, if I'm looking at it in terms of where I think I can add the most benefit, well, if you operate on somebody in sub-Saharan Africa, allow them to see from the age of 6 rather than 40, then their entire work and life, they can then get a job, contribute to society, you know.
Did you see that Mr. Beast video?
Which one?
Where, honestly, I can't remember the
exact... Oh, he paid for an X amount of cataract
surgery. Like about a million people.
Yeah.
To be able to see.
Yeah.
That's cool, isn't it?
It's very cool. I think it's partly because it was in America, though. And I do think we are quite fortunate. As much as the NHS is often a challenge for its employees, I think we are incredibly lucky to have pretty much free at the point of use healthcare. The reason he had to pay for so many people's cataract surgeries.
I don't know if it was in America. I think it might have been across Africa.
Oh, was it? Well, it was somewhere where it wasn't a public health, a publicly funded service.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can go and get a cataract surgery in a few months.
Is that what you really feel passionate about then? You feel passionate about setting up healthcare for specifically people that can't see very well or can't see at all?
Yeah.
I think getting eye surgery for them.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that's the aim.
I love that vision.
Yeah.
I'm down to donate to that.
Thank you.
I'm down to donate to that. Well, hey, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah.
Final words of wisdom or advice, people wanting to get into property, but maybe they're busy doctors, professionals.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard work initially. It is a bit of a slog. There's lots of no's, which is really quite interesting coming from like being at like a reasonably well-respected profession to then being told, no, stop talking to me by all these agents. But you kind of just have to push through it. And I think also like, you can actually really improve people's lives by providing good, high-quality accommodation and making a profit from it on the side. So you can do.
I love that, you can do a
lot of good.
I've really enjoyed this interview, and I love what you say about going from a doctor, well-respected, to going out with agents. It's so true.
Yeah.
Everyone's on the same. You can get on the academy. You've got a guy here who's 17 years old.
Absolutely.
Who's got bad credit? Who's up? And then you've got a lawyer, and they're on the same.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like when you're playing a board game, you go back to square one.
Yeah, it's quite humbling. I actually really liked it. It's nice to grind again and overcome those challenges.
Well, you're doing super well. I really appreciate you on the show.
No, thanks so much for having us.